company besides Russia's National Gazprom that even wants to drill in the Arctic because it is so extreme, so dangerous, so expensive. All the other oil companies have said it just doesn't make sense economically, certainly doesn't make sense environmentally or morally. Shell has gotten almost every permit it needs to drill except one last one. And our hope today is that by delaying this ship, it gives Obama time to take action, be the climate leader he says he wants to be, and deny this last permit. The boat that is here, as you said, is an icebreaker, and Shell's permit requires that this icebreaker be on site. Shell left Seattle with its rigs last month, got up to the Arctic. They're under enormous time pressure because there's only a certain number of weeks that the region is ice-free. In 2012, when Shell went up there, it was a disaster, and they crashed, and their contractor got charged with 8 felonies, and this time they have promised that they are safety-obsessed and Shell-ready, yet this icebreaker, which was up in Alaska just last week, ran into something and got a 39-inch hole in its hull. So it is down here now getting repaired on a tight.
Annie Leonard, we have 5 seconds. Can President Obama do anything about this now?
Absolutely. He can deny that last permit and take a stand for climate solutions. Absolutely.
Annie Leonard, thank you for being with us, standing by the bridge where Greenpeace activists have formed an aerial blockade. Annie Leonard, executive director of Greenpeace USA. And that does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Laura Gattas, Dean Ardina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Noreen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website's democracynow.org.
KBOO Portland. Time is 5 o'clock. Up next, KBOO Evening News.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Revival Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Willamette River Revival is a community-based river festival to celebrate and reconnect with the lower Willamette River and its cleanup. The Grand Ronde Tribe will host a salmon bake. There will also be tabling by environmental groups, Native American crafts, live folk music, storytelling, and other activities. Again, that's the Willamette River Revival, Sunday, August 2nd, from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, activists for climate justice remain suspended underneath the St. John's Bridge to block a Shell icebreaker ship from returning to the Arctic.
Local nonprofit group Janus Youth Services has officially unionized after a long battle by its low-paid employees.
And the dash cam footage of a police murder in Cincinnati has been released.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 29, 2015. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The dash cam footage from a police murder of a Cincinnati man has been released, and university police officer involved has been indicted for murder. Samuel DuBose, a 43-year-old father of 10, according to the Cincinnati Inquirer, was unarmed at the time of his arrest. He was pulled over for lacking a front license plate on his car. He did have a rear license plate. He was then shot and killed by the campus police officer who pulled him over. Now, a grand jury has indicted the University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing on charges of murder. The prosecutor appeared shocked at a body cam video of the shooting. He spoke bluntly about the incident, which he said should never have occurred. In an initial report, Tensing claimed that he was being dragged by the vehicle when he opened fire on it. Dieters, the district attorney, said the dash cam footage disputed that claim and alleged that the officer intentionally misled multiple investigators.
The city of Eugene has dropped charges against houseless activist Hedden Brew. Brew is with a campaign called Sleeps that began to protest for the right to sleep in 2012. Brew was recently arrested for protesting on the Wayne Morse Free Speech Plaza, a popular platform for activists to assert their First Amendment rights. The Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene defended Brew in the case. KBOO reporter Shade Samuelson spoke with Lauren Reagan, director and attorney with the CLDC.
I'm speaking with Lauren Reagan, director and attorney with the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon. Lauren, could you maybe start off telling me about what the CLDC does and where this need for pro bono legal defense comes from?
Sure. The CLDC is 11 years old now, and we basically provide legal support and resources to progressive social change activists. So we defend activists who get arrested and end up in the criminal court. And then we also sue police and government agencies when they violate the rights of activists, you know, either through excessive force or unlawful spying or, you know, or similar civil rights violations. We also do a lot of Know Your Rights trainings.
So how did the CLDC get involved with Hedden Brugge's case?
Well, we have been supporting the Occupy movement as well as this group called Sleeps that was sort of an organization that came out of Occupy Eugene. And that group is made up of unhoused activists and their allies, and many of them had been arrested and their, you know, the few possessions they had been stolen. And so the Sleeps campaign kind of came out of those issues and concerns. One of their protest tactics is to pop up some symbolic tents to try and draw attention to the fact that some people have nowhere to sleep except for a tent. And until, you know, the community can provide adequate shelter for these folks, at a minimum, we should be allowing them to sleep at night, you know, to be able to set up tents and sleep. And so they engaged in a campaign on the Wayne Morse Free Speech Plaza, which is one of our central free speech locations. It is right in the heart of downtown Eugene, and it is where the city, county, and state governments all are located. And they popped up some tents and basically had a protest that kept getting shut down by the county on a number of different occasions. They would basically try to come up with different ways to stop the protest. And each time that they would attempt this, they would go in and arrest the protesters. Well, they would order them to leave or arrest them. And each time the CLDC stepped in to represent them for free, because we strongly believe that in free speech locations that are called traditional public forums, that's where the most expansive First Amendment rights are supposed to be protected. And the county was basically trying to pick and choose pretty protests versus the protests they didn't really like, and, you know, basically trying to silence those activists. And particularly because the Sleeps campaign consisted of both unhoused activists and their allies, we believed that they really needed extra legal support. You know, for an unhoused person to take the risk of being arrested for a cause You know, that is a really big ask for somebody who is harassed and targeted by the police, you know, almost every day. So when they were willing to stand up for their rights and risk their liberty, you know, we absolutely were going to be there to help them for free. And so in a total of three separate incidents, one after the other, the county would shut down the plaza, would arrest people, and we would file motions to dismiss the charges based on constitutional grounds. And in all three, you know, basically the first two cases, the judge ruled that the county had acted unconstitutionally and they dismissed all the charges against the activists. I think there was like a total of 40 or so activists in those cases. And then Mr. Brugge was the third attempt by the county to shut down the plaza. And the case started off in the Eugene Municipal Court, and the court initially ruled that the county had a right to shut down the plaza and arrest him. And so we appealed to Lane County Circuit Court, and we had a hearing, and the court really kind of indicated that the judge was on our side. She got our legal arguments, and she was pretty troubled by the way the county and the city were attempting to enact, you know, what are clearly unconstitutional closure orders. And so after the hearing was over, the judge basically gave the city prosecutor's office one last chance to file a responsive brief, you know, basically said, look, I'll give you, you know, one more chance to try and come up with arguments that, you know, might justify what the county has done and what the city did in arresting Mr. Brugge. And on the deadline when they were supposed to file that brief, instead they filed a motion to dismiss themselves and dismissed the case against Mr. Brugge, so that the court could not issue a written opinion that would have clearly put the writing on the wall that once again the county had acted unconstitutionally. So basically what it means is, you know, on the one hand, it's a win for our client because he's not going to end up with a criminal conviction, which obviously that's positive. And on the other hand, you know, the fact that the city, after all this fight and all this money spent by them to try and litigate this matter, for them to drop it like this, you know, clearly shows that they basically, you know, did their research and realized that they didn't have a leg to stand on. And so in many ways, you know, this is a concession that, you know, what was going on was not right. But if they had allowed the court to actually enter a court opinion, then that opinion would have been binding on Lane County, and we would have had kind of, you know, written proof that what they did was unconstitutional and could not be done again.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me, Lauren.
You are welcome.
That was Lauren Regan with the Civil Liberties Defense Center. To learn more about the organization, you can visit cldc.org. This is Shade Samuelson with KBOO News.
13 activists are suspended from ropes hanging from the St. John's Bridge more than 14 hours after they rappelled down from the bridge early this morning. They are supported by around 150 kayaktivists who gathered Tuesday night in St. John's Cathedral Park to try to block a ship leased by the Shell Oil Company from exiting the harbor. The ship, the MSV Fenica, was in Portland for repairs to a gash in its hull discovered while en route to Arctic waters. KBOO's Kristen Yount is live on the scene and joins us now. Kristen, where are you right now and what's the situation?
Well, I am floating just south of the St. John's Bridge, and I can see the activists. They are suspended so elegantly from the bridge. It's really amazing. Yeah, that's where I am.
Well, it's been a hot day. We're curious how the activists suspended in the air have been dealing with the heat. Has anybody needed to come down?
I haven't seen anybody come down, but the cover of the bridge is pretty sufficient to keep them out of the sun. I noticed when I paddled under the bridge, it was quite cool under there, you know, relatively. And they have wind up there, too. So they, you know, without having spoken to any of them, I can assume that they are in the shade.
Have you observed any police presence?
The Coast Guard came through, and they were wavy and smiley. They didn't really They didn't even have their engines on, and we were practicing how to group our kayaks together and then disperse in a safe way. So they let us do that. They didn't say anything. So.
And what about the plan for tonight? Is this going to continue through the evening?
Yeah, I hear that soon. A lot of people went in to, I think, eat and rest up, and then later I do believe they're going to come back out. And, yeah, because the ship hasn't moved at all. It's still where it was earlier today.
And this might be a difficult one. Do you have any activists nearby that we might be able to speak with briefly?
No.
No, might be hard to... Hard to
no,
reach him.
I'm, yeah, it's like I said, most people went inside. There's just a few people, a few of us out here floating, sort of monitoring, see if any, if they try to sneak out or something. So, yeah, it's not, I don't see anybody really out in flotilla mode. Everybody's taking a break right now.
And what about you, Kristen? What made you decide to come out and take action against Shell's Arctic drilling operation?
Well, you know, to be honest, you can come down to this park and they will put you in a boat. And it is really nice out here. So, but yeah, it's thrilling. Aside from that, it is thrilling to see all these people literally risking their lives. I mean, it's no joke being in the middle of the Columbia River. No matter how calm it is, you know, there's always a calamity that could happen. So it's just really nice to see people bringing it, so to speak.
And why is it important for people to get involved in actions like this one?
Well, I think, you know, for one thing, it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, from what I see, Greenpeace activists kind of have a good time doing this. It's sort of like the extreme sports of activism. I mean, you know, like being out on this, hanging from the side of the bridge. Oh, so there are some people getting ready... Looks like they're calling the canoes in to start flotilla-ing, so I better go. But yeah, I think just in closing, yeah, I think it's really important to understand that, you know, we're fighting, or they're fighting for a reason. People coming out and just demonstrating that they love their natural habitat and they love the nature, and actually interacting with nature and being outside and being part of it. You really understand why you do it after all.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Kristen, and good luck.
All right, thanks.
Again, we have been speaking with one of the activists involved in the kayak blockade in the Willamette River going on right now. We'll have an in-depth report and an analysis later this hour at 5:45, so be sure to stay tuned for that.
Social workers at Janus Youth in Portland have won the right to form a union with AFSCME Council 75 after a year of organizing. Now that they have won a union, their next fight is getting a base wage of $15 an hour. Janus Youth is one of the largest nonprofits in the Pacific Northwest and provides programs and residential care for homeless and drug addicted youth in Portland and Multnomah County. KBOO News reporter Catherine Matichik spoke with Justin Norton Kirsten, an organizer with the group 15 Now PDX, one of the organizations supporting Janus Youth in their upcoming union negotiation.
I am speaking with Justin Norton Kurtzen, an organizer for 15 Now PDX. So Janus Youth social workers just voted to unionize with the AFSCME Council 75. Could you explain how that relates to 15 Now?
Sure. So yeah, it's 65 new members that are part of AFSCME at the Janus Youth facilities, and they're going to now be going into the process of bargaining for their first contract under the new union. And one of the main things that they already know that they're going to be pushing for in the contract is a $15 minimum wage.
So according to their website, many of their workers have large amounts of student debt as they're just recent college grads. What does a $15 right. minimum wage mean to this part of the workforce?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, these are, right, they're not fast food workers. They're not people who are uneducated, right? Like you just said, these are people with college degrees, and they have a lot of debt, and they have experience on the job too. And that, you know, they have experience working with at-risk kids and kids who have a lack of resources, and that, you know, they're only getting paid barely above $10 an hour for this really hard and important work that they're doing. And so, you know, a $15 minimum wage is going to go a long way, not only to help them pay their bills, you know, pay for their rent and the food that they need to eat, but it's going to go a long way to help them actually pay down that student debt, you know, that they acquired to get a job, presumably that would be good and that would, in terms of pay, and that would help them, you know, be able to afford a nice sort of comfortable life. But unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. You know, these are all people who are good at what they do, and if the place that they're working can't afford to pay them enough so that they can, you know, even afford the basic necessities of life, then those people are going to be looking for work elsewhere, you know, at a place that will pay them more. And so for Janice, by you know, giving them a higher base pay, like $15 an hour, that really helps them ensure that they keep quality employees, quality people at their facilities.
Do you think that this is just the next step in a community that's really changing in terms of minimum wage, or is it really still one fight at a time?
No, I mean, we see this actually as a big step. You know, things are really starting to heat up, and you know, it's really important to us that we work at the local level and do really take things one step at a time. But as we get closer to the upcoming legislative session and the 2016 election, these small battles and small victories are all going to build up together and help create the momentum and really the wave that we need to make sure that we can win statewide.
So like you alluded to, the nonprofit section is not the same as the corporate fast food industry or other industries that are getting a lot of media attention for the 15 Now fight. What would you say to people who claim that nonprofits just simply can't afford a $15 minimum wage?
Well, you know, I mean, most of these nonprofits, well, you know, Janice included, are funded by state and federal tax dollars. And so really the idea that these organizations don't have the money to pay decent wages is really a symptom of the austerity regime that we're living under. And you know, so I think the answer to the problem is for people to fight back against that austerity and fight back against all of the budget cuts and the corporate tax subsidies and tax breaks. And make sure that money is going to the programs that we need. But I mean these people are working with a really important and at-risk you know, youth population here, and it's important that work is funded, and it's important that the people who are doing that work are able to pay their bills. And so we really need to fight austerity and make sure that these programs get the money that they need.
Do you think how companies pay their workers reflects what we value in our society?
You know, I a lot of times I really think that we do. But I wonder, you know, I mean, teachers often are paid really low, but at the same time, I like to think that we really value teachers in our society. But unfortunately, in most cases, it seems like, yeah, you know, what people are paid does reflect the value that we place on them. And I think the fast food industry is a perfect example, right? I mean, people don't really value the labor that fast food employees provide, yet they're a really vital and important part of the service and restaurant sector. Nobody who works really should live in poverty. It doesn't really matter what job they're working. So in that sense, I do think that you're right, yeah. I would encourage people to support the Janus workers. And, you know, there's a whole lot of other groups of workers around Portland that are fighting for 15. And so, you know, just do what you can to support them.
I've been speaking with Justin Norton Kurtzen, an organizer for 15 Now PDX. This is Catherine Matichuk with KBOO News.
A Multnomah County auditor report examined nearly two-thirds of the workforce and found that white males have higher-paying jobs than others. The report looked at 91 jobs that make up about 63% of the county's workforce. The employees that were not included in the analysis were in positions with less than 30 employees. The auditor report found that white males earn an average of $32.16 per hour compared to $26.58 an hour earned by white females. And black males earn an average of $29.62, while Hispanic women earn $20.39. This means that employers have chosen more white males to work jobs paying over $32 an hour, such as corrections officers and deputy sheriffs. Hispanic males were mostly in positions such as library clerks and office assistants, which earn less than $23 an hour. Multnomah County Commissioner Julie Bailey said that it's critical that we continue our efforts to do recruitment to advance people up the skill chain, up job classifications, and to make sure there's not just equal pay, but there's advancement.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the KBOO Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Have you heard about the growing movement in the U.S. to recognize that nature has enforceable rights to exist, flourish, and evolve? It's one of the aspects of the community rights movement. A public interest law firm based in Pennsylvania, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, has been pioneering these legal efforts since 2006, helping dozens of communities to pass legally binding and locally enforceable community rights ordinances that include the rights of nature. Today, I'd like to share with you an excerpt from their webpage titled Rights of Nature, Frequently Asked Questions. What do we mean when we say that nature should have rights? Under the current system of law in almost every country, nature is considered to be property, a treatment which confers upon the property owner the right to destroy ecosystems and nature on that property. When we talk about the rights of nature, it means recognizing that ecosystems and natural communities are not merely property that can be owned, but are entities that have an independent right to exist and flourish. Why do we need to adopt new legal structures recognizing rights of nature? By most every measure, the environment today is in worse shape than when the major U.S. environmental laws were adopted over 40 years ago. These laws, including the United States Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and similar state laws, legalize environmental harms by regulating how much pollution or destruction of nature can occur under law, rather than preventing pollution and environmental destruction. These laws instead allow and permit it. In addition, under commonly understood terms of preemption, once these activities are legalized by federal or state governments, local governments are prohibited from banning them. Laws recognizing rights for nature begin with a different premise, that ecosystems and natural communities have the right to exist and flourish, and people, communities, and governments have the authority to defend those rights on behalf of those communities and ecosystems. Where have laws recognizing the rights of nature been adopted? The first laws establishing legal structures which recognized the rights of nature were adopted by local municipalities in the U.S., beginning in 2000 with Tamaqua Borough, Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania. Since then, more than 24 communities in the U.S. have adopted local laws that recognize the rights of nature. In November of 2010, the city of Pittsburgh became the first major municipality in the U.S. to recognize rights for nature. In September 2008, Ecuador became the first country in the world to recognize rights for nature in its constitution. What rights do those laws recognize? The earliest rights of nature laws recognized the right for ecosystems to exist and flourish. Others, including the Ecuadorian constitutional provisions adopted in 2008, recognized the right for nature to exist, persist, evolve, and regenerate. Those laws also recognized the right of any person or organization to defend, protect, and enforce those rights, and for payment of recovered damages to government to provide for the restoration of those ecosystems. Doesn't recognizing rights of nature just add an additional layer of regulation? No. Current environmental regulatory structures are mostly about permitting certain harms to occur, acting more to legalize the activities of corporations and other business entities than to protect our natural and human communities. Laws recognizing the rights of nature empower communities to reject governmental actions which permit unwanted and damaging development to occur by enabling communities to assert the rights of those ecosystems that would otherwise be destroyed. Although people have been talking about sustainable development for decades, very little has been done to change the structure of law to actually achieve that goal. laws recognizing the rights of nature finally codify the concept of sustainable development, disallowing those activities that would interfere with the functioning of those natural systems that support human and natural life. What happens when nature's rights and human rights conflict? The same thing that happens when different human rights conflict. A court weighs the harms to the interests and then decides how to balance them. Given that ecosystems and nature provide a life support system for humans, their interests must at times override other rights and interests. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a planet to inhabit that would support our continued existence. Of course, humans are an integral part of nature as well, which means that human needs must also be considered when the rights and interests of ecosystems come into conflict with those of humans. Doesn't this mean that rocks must be given lawyers? No. But what it does mean is that the rights of ecosystems and natural communities are enforceable independently of the rights of people who use them. That means that people within a community could step into the shoes of a mountain, stream, or forest ecosystem and advocate for the rights of those natural communities. It calls for a system of jurisprudence in which those ecosystems are actually seen in court, and that assesses damages according to the costs of restoring the ecosystem to its pre-damaged state. I've been reading an excerpt from the Rights of Nature Frequently Asked Questions page on the website of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. To learn more about the rights of nature, visit therightsofnature.org or CELDFrank.org. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can follow me on Twitter at CNFuegosPaul. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcnfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the ongoing direct action under the St. John's Bridge, where 13 activists are suspended midair, trying to stop the Shell Oil icebreaker rig from passing. This will be followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is hot and sunny, much like today, with a high of 103. Today in history, on July 29, 1932, the Bonus Marchers were violently expelled from Washington, D.C. The Bonus Marchers were World War I vets who were starving, like many others in the country, due to the Great Depression. They marched on Washington, demanding the release of promised bonus funds. Legislators refused their request, so 20,000 vets set up camp in Washington, trying to put further pressure on the government. President Herbert Hoover ordered the eviction of the Bonus Marchers, and two veterans were killed. The president then called on the army to disperse the remaining Bonus Marchers, and they were violently expelled from their D.C. encampment on July 29, 1932. Quote of the day is from Native American historian Vine Deloria, who said, quote, "This country was a lot better off when the Indians were running it."
It's 5:32, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When it comes to pursuing their prey, sharks are master maneuverers. Loan sharks, that is. These days, this usurious species goes by the less threatening name of payday lenders. But they are no less voracious, targeting folks in rough financial straits and luring them with easy money come-ons. With lethal interest rates of more than 700%, automatic renewal clauses, and other razor-sharp gotchas, a $500 payday loan can sink a hapless borrower thousands of dollars into debt. That's why states have been restricting the sharks' interest rate gouging and entrapment techniques. But with a flip of their tails, many payday lenders are simply swimming around state laws by operating online and offshore from such regulatory safe harbors as the Bahamas, the Isle of Man, and Malta. From there, sharks can make loans, then begin devouring their borrowers' bank accounts, even in states that ban such loans. How can shady operators pull off billions of dollars worth of these devious and maybe illegal transactions each year? With inside help from such pillars of the financial establishment as Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo. Of course, these upstanding corporate citizens don't dirty their hands or reputations by making these predatory loans, but they willingly allow offshore sharks to tap directly into the borrower's checking accounts and withdraw unconscionable interest payments electronically and mercilessly. There's a four-letter F word for what the banks are doing to their own depositors: fees. Automatic withdrawals by the sharks can cause a tsunami of overdrafts in a borrower's bank account, and banks happily collect fat fees for every overdraft. This is Jim Hightower saying, for more information and action, go to responsiblelending.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
An Albuquerque man is dead following a 911 call that many say crossed the lines of professionalism. Jaden Chavez Silver died at the hospital of a gunshot wound that he received at a party. People trying to save the 17-year-old's life called 911. In the recently released tapes of the 911 call, Jaden's friends can be heard telling him to hold on and instructing him to continue breathing. While about 3 minutes of the call are missing, the end of the call remains intact. The operator on the call asks the caller several times if the victim is breathing. Initially, the caller answers the question. However, after several moments of being prompted with the same question, the caller becomes frustrated. The call ends with the 911 operator telling the caller, quote, "Okay, you know what, ma'am? You can deal with it yourself. I am not going to deal with this, okay?" End quote. At that point, the 911 operator hangs up the call. Emergency services were still dispatched to the shooting. However, the conduct of the operator has been under intense scrutiny. The operator has been placed on leave while the case is reviewed. In the meantime, there have been no arrests in what was labeled as a drive-by shooting, and friends of the victim insist that he was an innocent bystander.
News reports surfaced yesterday about the death of a 24-year-old Native American woman named Sarah Lee Circle Bear, who was found unresponsive in a South Dakota jail cell on July 6th. The Lakota woman had been arrested on a violation of her bond. Witnesses say that before being transferred to a holding cell, she repeatedly told her jailers that she was in excruciating pain. However, jail staff allegedly dismissed her claims, telling her to knock it off and quit faking. Witnesses say that other inmates cried out for the jail staff to help Circle Bear, to which they responded by picking her up off the floor and dragging her into a holding cell. Later, she was found unresponsive and was transferred to a nearby hospital where she died. The death of a Native American woman recalls the police abuse and killings of people of color around the country, most recently notable being Sandra Bland. Sarah Sunshine Manning is an activist that wrote about Circle Bear's story, saying that in the state of South Dakota, where Native Americans are the largest minority and hate crimes are reported at high levels, it is time to demand a thorough investigation into her neglect and her death. It is time to demand better treatment of Native women and justice for Sarah.
Georgia is dumping troubled kids into Jim Crow schools. A recent report by the Department of Justice found that Georgia has been placing kids with disabilities into segregated facilities called the Georgia Network for Educational and Therapeutic Support. KBOO reporter Shade Samuelson spoke with Marion Wang, a reporter at ProPublica who has been covering the segregation of Georgia schools.
I'm speaking with Marion Wang, a reporter at ProPublica who has been covering the segregation of Georgia schools. Marion, maybe you could start off just summing up what has been going on.
Yeah, so the Department of Justice just released the findings of its investigation into Georgia's psychoeducational schools. That's what they were called for quite some time. These are schools that were set up to educate students who had behavioral issues, a range of behavioral issues, or, you know, some people would say disabilities that affected their behavior in some way. And so that could be things like autism or ADHD or just think, you know, any kinds of behaviors that schools didn't really have the time or willingness to sort out. And so they looked at these schools and just found that it was a completely, you know, separate and unequal system of education that these kids were in. They were essentially being warehoused in many of the same facilities that had actually been used for racial segregation, you know, back in the days of Jim Crow. And some of these facilities were just lacking gyms, lacking libraries, lacking cafeterias, a lot of the amenities that you expect of a traditional public school.
So how long has this been going on?
Well, this network was set up in Georgia in the 70s, and it was supposed to be a progressive idea, like let's provide more services to this population and try to educate them, provide more intensive therapeutic services. And so this system has been around for 40 years, and what happens is that the Department of Justice found schools were often just sort of shunting kids into this, you know, after one incident or a string of minor incidents, that, you know, a school, if it didn't have the bandwidth or the interest or the resources to even, or the flexibility really in its services to sort of accommodate any kind of behavior that was out of the norm or that might take a little more of a teacher's time, they were often sort of defaulting to this system and saying, well, this exists, this is where your kid belongs.
So do they have any basis that they're using to deem these students less able than others?
That's the thing, is that a lot of the time, these students, according to the Department of Justice, did not need to be in this kind of very restrictive setting. And one of the things, one of their findings was, listen, you guys really need to be building these services into the integrated settings, because many of these kids can thrive with the proper supports in place in a neighborhood school. And they did find some examples of kids that, you know, were had some of these same disabilities, but were thriving in these neighborhood school environments that had properly supported them.
So something that stands out to me in this story is that these kids are being kept in the same buildings that Black children were kept in during the Jim Crow era. And so I'm wondering if there's any racial or gender disparity in the kids that are that they're choosing to segregate.
That is pretty common with a lot of, you know, there, I think, students with disabilities, and, you know, there's a racial difference as well, often in terms of many educational outcomes. And you see that with a lot of discipline. It would not be surprising to me, but I don't have the data on this GNETS program. One of the advocates was telling me that a lot of the data isn't available for these programs, and there's not much transparency into them because they're technically classified as programs and not schools. And so for that reason, there's not some of the same data that one might expect from a school.
I know that the Justice Department has threatened the state with a lawsuit. Do you know what the status of that is?
I had asked the Georgia Attorney General's office, and they gave me a no comment. I know that they are going to give Georgia a chance to correct this, which is not going to happen overnight.
Right. So what's going to happen to the students? Are they going to be reintegrated into the regular schools?
That's what the Justice Department wants to see. You know, it had some pretty strong language saying that Georgia needs to redirect its services and programs and its training for teachers to these more integrated settings and transition more of these kids out.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
So that was Marianne Wang speaking about segregation in Georgia schools. You can follow her on Twitter at the handle MARIANCW. And to learn more about the issue, you can visit propublica.org. I'm Shade Samuelson with KBOO News.
15,000 people in Finland attended rallies and protests yesterday to denounce anti-immigration comments made by Olli Immonen. Olli Immonen is a lawmaker from the Finns Party, the second largest party in parliament, which has backed strict immigration laws. The protests follow comments made in a Facebook post by Immonen. Immonen wrote that, "I'm dreaming of a strong, brave nation that will defeat this nightmare called multiculturalism. This ugly bubble that our enemies live in will soon enough burst into a million little pieces. I have strong belief in my fellow fighters. We will fight until the end for our homeland and one true Finnish nation. The victory will be ours." Timo Soini, leader of the Finns party, said that Immonen's comments were harmful to the party. Protesters are voicing their support for a multicultural Finnish society and asking that Immonen resign.
An Amnesty International report released today says that Israel committed war crimes and human rights violations in Gaza last summer. The 50-day military offensive in the Gaza Strip resulted in the deaths of more than 1,400 Palestinians, including 539 children. Thousands more were wounded, in addition to a massive civilian displacement and destruction of property. Israeli forces detained thousands of Palestinians, some of whom were reported being tortured, and continued to hold around 500 prisoners without trial. The Israeli government has also been criticized recently for detaining and expelling thousands of foreign immigrants, mainly refugees from Africa, escaping from genocidal war zones. The new Amnesty report states that there is overwhelming evidence that Israeli forces committed disproportionate or otherwise indiscriminate attacks, which killed civilians in their homes, on the streets, and in vehicles, and injured many more.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's broadcast is Catherine Matichuk, Shade Samuelson, myself, and Joe Aaron. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen and something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Orrin Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Adrian Caboy, local activist with Black Lives Matter, about the Black Lives Matter conference in Cleveland last week and what activists hope to accomplish now that they're back. At 9, Teresa